Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Candelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer. And throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. In the Podbooth studio with me is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight Universities, and we'll be speaking with Michael Mintram, Professor of Public Policy at Monash University. Professor Mintram is a globally recognised authority on public policy and policy analysis, and currently serves as the inaugural Director of Better Governance and Policy, a university-wide research focus area. His latest book with Andrew Gunn, Public Policy and Universities, The Interplay of Knowledge and Power, has just been published. Professor Mintram, your book examines the unprecedented transformation of higher education around the world, recognising that in the global knowledge economy, universities are of paramount importance to governments worldwide. But it seems the relationship between universities and governments is changing, and it's often become a lot more fractious. Why do you think that is?
Ron, I think that the realisation has emerged that universities are incredibly important assets to the modern nation state in a way that perhaps hasn't been the case in the past. And what I mean by that is the recognition that economies are increasingly driven by knowledge, that the comparative advantage that any economy can have over others is a function of the knowledge capabilities of the workforce. Now, to an extent, that's always been true, but you can look at, say, countries in the past, their comparative advantage would be built around things like having major ports or having particular natural resources, you know, coal, wood, that kind of thing, agricultural resources. And so those things could compensate for a lack of education of the workforce, but this seems to be changing. And so the notion of comparative advantage is bound up with the notion of the knowledge economy. You know, a classic example would be, say, Singapore, where, you know, one of the mantras they have in Singapore is that they have to sort of back themselves. And so they put a lot of emphasis on being a knowledge economy. Actually, in some sense, that narrative downplays the fact that Singapore is strategically placed where it is as a shipping route. It's been a major shipping route for centuries, but that notion that they need to, you know, really back themselves on the knowledge economy stuff because that's their key resource is an important one. And I think increasingly governments are seeing that. As a result of that, they're kind of wanting to put more pressure on the universities to deliver against those kind of goals for the knowledge economy. So I'm making sure that they're producing relevant research and research that can be applied to aspects of manufacturing and technology development. That also that they're training a workforce that's really fit for the current and the emerging economy.
So what does that mean then for the autonomy of universities as governments begin to realise that these universities help generate wealth for the nation state? They interfere more. You know, they have a say over where the grants go, where the money goes.
Well, this is actually a really key point, and it's something that we wanted to capture in the book by calling it the subtitle is The Interplay of Knowledge and Power, because over the past, let's say, from the mid-1970s onwards, there's been a move by governments to kind of reduce the amount of funding that they give to universities in terms of, like, student support. So here in Australia, the development of the HECS scheme, for example, student loan schemes, increasingly you've seen those around the world. So to the extent that students are now covering their own way, you know, to a high degree, it's still subsidised, but covering their own way at university, you could say that the state has been backing off a bit in support. At the same time, it's that kind of recognition that there's a whole bunch of things that universities are doing that really matter to the state. So you have this kind of, on the one hand, moving out. It looks like government's kind of moving out of higher ed, and at the other hand, they're wanting to get in and regulate it more. So it is a very interesting phenomenon. It's not, we see it here in Australia, but it's not just in Australia. I think that many state universities in the US have found a similar kind of thing, that the state governments have rolled back their funding, but at the same time, they've increased their kind of regulation and their desire to have influence on the operations of the university.
It's a really interesting point that Michael makes, Ron, because for the Group of Eight universities, and this is something that actually Professor Glyn Davis used to comment on, who's now head of Prime Minister and Cabinet, for the Group of Eight universities, on average, if you exclude the HECS contribution that they make, which is basically a loan which is repaid, funding from the government, federal government, is around a third of our funding. Two-thirds is sourced elsewhere. So at the same time as government has retreated from actually funding universities in that context, Michael's point is very well made, that we've had kind of, you know, a imbalance in terms of the regulatory environment on top of universities. And so that tension is alive and well, where public universities, in all sense, you know, as we should be, but in fact, a lot of our income is coming from a private source. Mm. And I think, you know, how we manage that, and as I'm interested that you said it's not just in Australia, but of course the Australian university system is funded very differently. And we should champion that our students, you know, it's free at point of entry and we've got the deferred payment scheme. So how does that then compare with, say, in the US, which has a very different model of state and public and private universities, Michael? And is there that same, you touched on it, is there really that same amount of regulatory oversight from their various governments?
It's kind of complicated, but the funding of student loans in the US is by the federal government. But then the state governments provide a lot of the infrastructure and sustaining support for the state university systems. It's true that in the US there's more private universities than you see elsewhere, so a higher proportion. But actually, in terms of the overall country, the number of private institutions is actually pretty small. And so they are in some ways still beholden to quite a lot of that sort of regulatory oversight that we were talking about, that they don't kind of get away from it by being non-public. So, you know, they still have to apply for the same grants, they still have to have the same research ethics, and they still have a range of things about, you know, their treatment of students, if you like, the selection of students and so on, that is subject to regulation. So it's kind of messy in some ways. And an interesting thing that Once the state governments in the US started getting into creating more universities and university systems, there was a tendency for the development of private universities to stop. And I think that's been borne out. I can't think of not that many new private universities in the US over the last, say, 50 years.
But that is true for Australia too. That is true for Australia too. We only have a handful of private universities. It is largely a public system, isn't it? What's the barrier to entry for private universities then? I mean, that's probably another podcast discussion, but it's an interesting point that you raise.
It is interesting because I guess, you know, Bond University is the kind of standout in Australia, and they offer things like, you know, you can do your undergrad degree in 2 years rather than the usual three, which is interesting as a point of comparison. They also have very small class sizes. So there is a distinction there. You would think that there would be perhaps even more of a market in Australia than there has been to date for private entities.
That might be your next book.
The other thing, I mean, when we talk about the HECS issue, though, we saw how the previous government altered the fees charged for certain courses like humanities, making it more expensive and therefore less attractive, while at the same time making other courses cheaper and more attractive. It's a public policy issue implemented by government which changes the university landscape. What do you think of the long-term impacts of that on the university system?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Ron, because in some sense, from a policy perspective, it's a funny kind of lever in the sense that the students have to pay back their loans quite a long time into the future. So the immediate impact of a price change wouldn't affect them in the same way that an immediate price change on items in the supermarket would affect the consumption of individuals and households. So I think that at the margin, there may be some change there, but I actually think that if the government wanted to reduce the amount of interest that students had in the humanities and social sciences, there were a couple of others in there, that they might actually think about wanting to get in and change the curriculum in the high schools, because I think that's where quite often students' kind of passions and interests are developed.
It's actually had a perverse outcome, though, hasn't it? Because
it hasn't
actually had the outcome that the previous government wanted. And I suspect under the new government, we might see some
changes. Yeah. To another issue, though, Professor, the use of higher education as a bit of a lever by governments more generally, I wanted to focus on China. Many Chinese students come to our universities. Do you think that we can use them as a tool in some way to improve a relationship with China, given that they're such a fundamental part of our university system?
Yes, I think we could potentially do that. Again, it's kind of complicated because I think that the Chinese government has looked at the numbers of students going overseas for their education and has wondered what can we do within China to attract more of those students to enroll domestically in our universities. And so over the last couple of decades, there's been massive investments in China in the university systems with the idea of making it more attractive for people to train there. So I think it's kind of an interesting thing about movement of people historically. There was a time not that long ago, moving into the first probably two or three decades of the 20th century, where American students interested in science were pretty much always going to do their PhDs in Germany. They didn't feel that there was the capability or capacity in the United States to train up in the way that they needed. So these kind of things happen that way. Of course, why I give that example is that by the end of the 20th century, you'd see many students from Europe going to do their graduate degrees, their PhDs in the United States. So these things do change over time. But look, I think to come back to your question, it's a sort of a cultural diplomacy question. I think that the universities are fundamental in building these kind of soft power relationships, if you like, or making those relationships more possible. Someone who has gone to another country and received a higher degree there, I think, is always going to be grateful to that country for what they received there. And so that's actually very good for international relations.
So how do you think we manage that issue of soft power, in particularly with relation to Chinese students compared to some of our competitors like, Canada, the UK, the US, when it comes to universities more generally?
I think Australia's got a really great track record in that regard. I don't think that we're behind our competitors at all with respect to that. And I think that we've got, there's a lot about sort of proximity, but also the nature of Australian society that actually makes it an attractive proposition to come here. And I think it'll be an attractive proposition to come here for a long time into the future as well.
You've got a section in your book called Student Spies and Security. This is a very interesting topic, particularly to the Group of Eight and in the context that we've been operating in the last few years. We were a founding member of the University Foreign Interference Task Force, which is a government university group. It seems it's just been completely sort of a prevailing dominance of security issues, which have dominated, obviously, the policy environment for universities. How significant a threat to the independence of universities do you believe is this issue?
It's probably not a massive threat, actually. I think that the desire to do more vetting is probably okay. A lot depends on how it's managed. But what I would say is that this is a really good example of a kind of a result of a confluence of factors. That on the one hand, there's been a desire for Australian universities to attract more foreign students, and that's partly because of changes in government funding. And so then as we have that happening, that dynamic happening, we then see this kind of concern arising about where you've got so many of these students in our classes. Is the kind of research knowledge that is something that we don't want to lose being taken out the door, if you like, as a result of that? So it's almost like a manufactured crisis. One that it's not sort of our own making so much, but it is. You start to see these kind of factors coming together, and for Andrew Gunn and I, that was sort of an interesting case of to kind of reinforce the point we wanted to make, is that the public policy context in which universities operate is really complicated and complex, and that there is probably more need for careful analysis of what's going on in this area, both in the part of the universities, but also on the part of, of governments to sort of think hard about what kind of relationship they want to have with universities, to see them as the resource they are, and also to sort of be managing these risks quite carefully. So that example you gave, Vicky, is one of, I think, where a perceived risk was kind of blown up, perhaps out of proportion in some ways, more than it needed to. And there are other issues like that that I think are kind of interesting. And yes, we really were aware of the political dynamics associated with that, and saying, well, you know, why has this arisen, and what are the implications of that around sort of the autonomy of universities? Mm.
But do you think the universities were caught out a bit in terms of not having the right procedures and policies in place, or do you think that government has overblown the risk, or a bit of both?
Well, look, it's a bit of both, and I guess maybe you could imagine a scenario where the whole matter could have been dealt with in a way that wasn't controversial and wasn't sort of antagonistic between the government and the universities, but it kind of got played out in a way that looked like a problem there. I mean, I think in terms of just basic regulation of a risk and management of a risk, you could imagine scenarios where that could have been handled in a much more positive and mutually beneficial way for the government and for the universities, which wouldn't have meant actually stepping back from kind of surveillance, monitoring what was going on with the students, but just doing it in a way that was able to create standard operating procedures that weren't going to lead to front page newspaper stories.
So in what way, though? I mean, there's this tension about, you know, knowledge, you know, leaving our shores, security issues. You know, public policy makers have to manage that, and the universities as well. How do they do that?
Well, Ron, I mean, I think, first of all, from an analytical perspective, you might say, well, you know, how many cases do we reckon have actually happened here of people who have been trained in Australia, who have gone back to China and have taken information with them that was really important to China, to China's defence capabilities? That, I mean, I think, I don't know, it's an empirical question. But the way that it was presented was as though this was like a massive security breach for us as a country. And I just, you know, I don't know that when things are put in that kind of way, that kind of language that sort of inflames the situation, I don't know that that's not the most effective for thinking about productive ways forward. That's what I'm sort of getting at.
So you think a lot of this was in some respects a bit of a media beat up as well?
Again, we'd have to say, you know, what are the actual numbers on this? You know, how many cases of card carrying spies do we actually know of? You know, and then go from there.
In your book, you write about the three missions of universities: teaching, research, and the third mission. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, the third mission notion is one that actually, you know, Andrew Gunn told me this is used much more in the UK than elsewhere. But it's the kind of notion of the university is sort of entrepreneurial, that a bunch of things go on around the edge of the university that aren't strictly research and aren't strictly teaching, and that over time this has developed and more so than was the case earlier. So, you know, one that I quite like the example of is universities creating startup companies or making space available for startups. They also, there are some instances where they've worked with property developers to create kind of research parks, that kind of thing. In some ways, how I sort of see the third mission is it's kind of like in the US, most governors of states and most university presidents would look at the situation in Silicon Valley and say, wouldn't it be fantastic if we could replicate that in our backyard? And, you know, actually, the pretty good example of that replication desire was played out by the state of North Carolina immediately after World War II, where they said, what can we do to attract more research resources, more research capability to the state? And so they put funding into state-funded research labs, and that ultimately attracted federal funding for more labs. And so you get the Research Triangle area, Research Triangle Park, and even to this day, the proportion of PhDs per head of population is higher in North Carolina than in any other state in the US. And that was very much a kind of a creation that came from observing what had happened, you know, basically with the relationship between the Department of Defense and Stanford University in World War II, and that sort of developing into, you know, what is now, you know, this incredible powerhouse economically we call Silicon Valley.
And I think Australia has been slow off the mark. I'm very familiar with the North Carolina example, and also in the UK. I mean, they have an element of funding which is third stream funding, and it is to fund exactly as you say, that sort of the knowledge output in terms of startups, etc. And, you know, I can remember talking about this actually sort of 15 years ago as something that we should be doing, but I was just actually not looking at my phone because I wasn't listening to you, but pulling up a slide that I saw just recently about Melbourne being a leading global location for biotech R&D with a massive precinct there with Melbourne and Monash universities. And so it's not that we don't have them, but there's not that recognition of that third stream funding. And I think we've talked about in previous podcasts, Ron, about commercialization funding and translation funding. And it kind of goes to that. It's not exactly the same as you've the examples you've just given, Michael, but that's where you'd want to be sitting here, not you and I, but maybe in 30 years' time. And we've got those big sort of precincts which are generating the PhD students and the knowledge and the startups, and they're sort of incubators really in a sense.
And there have been some big announcements just recently at Melbourne Uni about research funding. I just want to move to another issue. In your book, Professor Mintram, you write that students bring in the money, but research generates academic prestige, and that evidence of research quality and income generation are almost always more valuable than evidence of exceptional teaching performance. What does this mean for the ongoing role of teaching in our universities?
It's a massive dilemma. And I actually think that the COVID-19 pandemic has, in some sense, had a salutary effect because it's led universities to realise just how incredibly important it is that they manage the teaching function really well and ensure that that all students feel really satisfied with the education they're getting, that the education is being delivered in ways that make the best use of available technology and all that kind of thing. So I think that there is a bit of a correction going on. But it is interesting, you know, I remember as an assistant professor in the US that someone told me one day, you know, focus on your research, be a good teacher, but don't try to be an excellent teacher. And then there was this comment that was, you know, if someone says to you, you're not doing very well in your research, it's going to take you 3 years to turn that around. If they say to you, you're not doing very well in your teaching, it'll take you 3 weeks to turn that around. So, you know, figure out what you're going to do here. And I think that that's a sort of a very classic kind of mantra that we shouldn't, as researchers, we shouldn't try to, you know, become really highly regarded by students as a good teacher. It's a really unfortunate situation because remember, the whole basis of the research university was the Humboldtian model that emerged in Germany around about in the, you know, early 1800s, and it was the view that researchers really needed to be doing some teaching because that kind of kept them grounded, and also that teachers needed to be doing research because that was keeping them at the cutting edge of their discipline so that they could transform that on. Plus, they were training the next generation of researchers. So I think somewhere along the line that kind of obvious synergy has kind of been lost. Not, I don't think so much in the practices of the universities, but in some sense in the discussions among academics and researchers, there's been that sort of tendency to denigrate teaching and to really glorify research to a point where I think that has at times been somewhat dysfunctional.
I mean, your book is a lot about inherent tensions between these kind of two opposing sides, and it's writ large in terms of teaching and research, and of course we are research intensive universities, and our universities would argue very strongly that good teaching informs good research and good research informs good teaching. But to go right back to the beginning of the discussion we've been having and talking about the interplay of knowledge and power, in a sense, and to relate it to this teaching issue, I just wonder whether governments over time have looked at us as universities, as a sector, not just talking about the Group of Eight, and thought, well, we're not spending, or not in terms of resources, but we're just not allocating enough of our energy towards the teaching, and we're spending too much time on research at the detriment of teaching outcomes. Now, I mean, you know, we could have a very academic discussion about why. I mean, I don't necessarily believe that's true, but I wonder what governments think. And then is that come into some of the interplay that we've had with government being annoyed with us, really, because they think that we're focusing too much over here on the blue sky research and we're not focused on actually we need more engineers and we need them now. This sort of tension that I think between output and input.
It's a really wonderful discussion point, Vicky, actually. And I think one, in the book, we kind of talk about this model, the world-class university model, which was kind of put forward by the OECD in the early years of this century. And so it's been around for 20 odd years. And it's one that really puts an enormous amount of emphasis on quality of research. So it's sort of like everyone wants to have, you know, a Harvard or a Stanford university in their backyard, right? And so, I mean, I think that for us, looking at Singapore, National University of Singapore would be a good example there. There are others around. But I think that in the Australian context, because you've got, like, for example, with a group of eight, you've got eight universities, they're all pretty strong contenders. Mm. It's not like the government can pick one particular university and say, we're going to make this one the shining light.
Some of
light.
My eight would think that they are the shining light, frankly.
Sure. I know they would. But, you know, what's interesting that we talk about in the book is, okay, if you are a world-class university and you're loved by your government, you get lots of resources put your way, that's fantastic. But what about the others in the system? And so this becomes kind of an interesting question of then what kind of universities do we actually want to have in Australia? And is it a one-size-fits-all university too? So there's a whole lot there. I mean, I think that the fact that we have these amazing research powerhouses in Australia is just phenomenal, and it's just such a great thing for the future of Australia. I wonder sometimes whether politicians, you know, really understand just what an amazing set of resources they have pretty much in all their big cities. This is just a great thing. But the emphasis on teaching, you know, I think it absolutely has to be there. I'm not sure, Vicky, whether it is that the politicians look at the universities and think they're doing a lousy job of teaching or anything like that. I'm just not sure, because I kind of feel that in the general population, when people look at universities, they're always thinking of them as primarily places where people go to learn stuff, you know, to get their degrees. And they don't necessarily think a whole lot along the lines of, like, okay, there's just incredible world-class research happening there. The time where I think that became really, really significant was just recently in Australia with the pandemic, and just how important finding a vaccine for COVID-19 was, and what an important role the universities played in that. And this is like absolutely cutting-edge research was needed in order to find a vaccine. And that's where you kind of realize that despite all the rhetoric out there about universities not pulling their weight and all the rest of it, who could have come up with a vaccine for COVID-19 in that short amount of time? Would you have left it up to a consultancy? Would you have asked the Department of Education or the Department of Technology? Mm. I mean, you go down the list here and you realize we absolutely needed the universities in that instance. And they delivered in spades. And it's just incredible. So, you know, I think we can actually see more examples of that, how the capabilities that are based in universities can be incredibly important for really changing the trajectories of societies.
Actually, it's a point that Vicky's often made in podcasts about you don't have to go to a university to have benefited from the work that they do. And, you know, the point that you raise about vaccines and the time of the pandemic is right on the money. I just want to move on to one other point, Michael, in your book, and we'll give it a plug here, Public Policy and Universities, the Interplay of Knowledge and Power. You say that public policy should encourage universities to be forward-thinking and realise their potential to create a better world. This follows on from what we've seen with the pandemic. Do you have examples, apart from the one that you've just spoken of, that you know, you can see this happening across the world?
Universities being forward.
Yeah, and having a positive impact, you know, as you say in your book, you know, working towards a better world.
Well, I think that there are many, many examples, and often they're probably not, you know, they don't receive the attention that they deserve. There's a huge amount going on at the moment around artificial intelligence and making sure that it is a source for good in society. I think in general, universities can be, they're not always, but they can be a voice for groups in society that may not necessarily be heard. And so departments of education on campuses or faculties of education, training up the next generation of early childhood education teachers, for example, that's just a massive contribution they can make to a really thriving multicultural Australia, for example. So it's right there. There's this all this capacity there. Some of them are already doing it, you know, but there's room for more of that. So those are just a couple of things. Healthcare contributions, which is related to the COVID point. Some of the engineering, all the sustainable development, dealing with climate change, moving towards renewable resources, renewable energy sources, that kind of thing. The universities are the places we'll be looking to for the knowledge advances that are going to fire that up. So, you know, I think that there's just an enormous amount there. Is it untapped? I don't think it's untapped, but I think it's sometimes unrealized, unrealized by some politicians and perhaps also by some media. And so, you know, as a result of that, when something happens, people get upset about the funding of universities or something, they sort of think, okay, this is just the university community whinging again, not recognising that major contribution that they make to society.
And that is the nicely put reason we do these podcasts, because the majority of the population think that kids go to uni and they get a degree and then they get a job. And there is a proportion of the population who don't even know that we do research, and that's on us. You know, we need to articulate that better. And I think you're right. It's not that it's untapped. I don't think we communicate that well. So thank you, because I think you've wrapped that up quite nicely in terms of what we do beyond just the teaching side of universities, which is absolutely critical as well, obviously.
And thank you for the book. I mean, Public Policy and Universities, The Interplay of Knowledge and Power. Great work by you and Andrew Gunn. Thank you so much for your time today, Professor Michael Mintram.
Thank you very much. It's been great to talk with you both.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to the debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.